Good morning. This is a little bit different of a sight than you're used to seeing. I've only seen it a couple once before preach. This is obviously a first for us. Before we got together, some of the pastors that we knew, would call me the Swiss Army knife, just because I knew how to do everything at least reasonably well enough to get it done. And then when we got together, we got called the two for one, because we could get done just about anything that we were asked to do. This is basically that, just continued into pastoral ministry in our lives. So,
and so while Franklin describes us as a twofer, as we've been called in the past, I like to see us as Priscilla and Aquila, who were close friends of Paul and a dynamic ministry duo. They're an outstanding husband and wife team who ministered together in the early church and found in Acts 18. So here we are, Advent 2020. It's hard to believe that we found ourselves in another season of Advent. We've been here before, some more than others, but there's something about Advent this year that just makes the waiting feel so much more tangible or real. Maybe it's because this year has felt like it's dragged on for some months and other months have flown by. The best analogy I heard this week in a podcast is that 2020 has felt like an accordion. It's fast and then it's slow, and then it's fast and then it's slow. It has just felt like a year of waiting.
The best analogy I've heard is 2020 has been the worst decade ever.
So we're no strangers to waiting, and we know that you aren't either. Our relationship, as many are, involved just a season or two of waiting. So let's give you all just a quick overview. So we started dating in June 2014 after we first met in October 2013. After dating, it wasn't long before we knew we wanted to get married. So fast forward to December 2015, Franklin asked me to marry him while we were in Buffalo on a youth retreat.
The most romantic of places, surrounded by teens everywhere.
But I had 2 years left of graduate school while Franklin was planning on going back to school in the fall to pursue a degree in theology. We also lived 3.5 hours apart, so that makes things a little bit difficult. So we had to wait to get married. And while the waiting was difficult, it was where we had to be. And it was in the waiting that we both continued our studies to prepare us for our future careers. We also continued to serve together in ministry as youth leaders. We also invested in premarital counseling to learn more about each other, our expectations as we entered marriage, and to how better communicate. This time in between allowed us to prepare for what was to come. The waiting allows for preparation. So let's start this morning with a question. What do you do when you are waiting? When there's something that you're really, really excited about, what are you doing? So when I first heard this question in a podcast, my initial thought was, I really don't do too much during that time. I know I get really impatient. I might start to complain just a little bit.
I refresh the webpage for FedEx or UPS a million times, waiting to see, oh, why has it been sitting in Syracuse for 3 hours? It should have left there already.
So I realized that while I'm impatient, I also get restless. I get anxious. Sometimes I even get a physiological response, like my heart starts racing. I start pacing back and forth. There's a restless energy that's present. I think of those moments when I'm waiting for a text message reply or a Facebook message, and you're just watching those three little dots on the phone screen. Then to have somebody just completely erase their message and you never know what they were even going to say. Or last week we were waiting for a Black Friday deal and we kept refreshing the page, waiting for it to be midnight so that we could get the deal.
And then we found out that the deal had been going on all day and it didn't matter. And most of what we were looking for was gone.
Or I think of those moments that I'm waiting for an appointment, especially if I've planned that in the middle of my day and I have to get back to work and they're running a little bit late. I sit there, I'm looking at my Fitbit watch to see what time it is. I'm checking my phone. I'm impatient. So the podcast went on to explain that what we do while we are waiting is an indication of the condition of our heart. We don't wait well. We get so caught up in the moment, or we're so focused on the future, that we miss what we need to be doing in the waiting. So while we're in this season of Advent, in this time of waiting, I think we need to ask the second question that this podcast posed. Are our hearts conditioned and postured in a place to receive the coming King? Or is there some work that needs to be done to receive him? What are we doing to prepare? We find ourselves today in the midst of this season of Advent. It is a time of waiting, expectant waiting, and preparing. It's quite familiar to all of us, as we are all waiting on something. We are living in the already, but the not yet. Joel Mutalame, the director of theology for Proverbs 31, depicted this perfectly in his post regarding Advent.
So we have the incarnation, or the birth of Christ, in the already. It's things that have already happened. We live in the but, the Advent, and then the not yet, the return of Christ to seize his bride, the church.
So Joel writes, Advent is a tension of our existence between the brilliance of the incarnation and our anticipation of the beauty of Christ's promised return, the consummation. Advent is in the in-between, the already, but the not yet. Joel goes on to say that we are smack in the middle of a promise from the past, Christ's death, burial, resurrection, and ascension, and the hope, and the future hope of his return to right all the wrongs. And in this in-between, we are waiting. In our own lives, we are all waiting on something. Waiting to be done with high school, waiting to be done with college, waiting for a spouse, waiting for a child to come home, waiting for the test results or a diagnosis, waiting to be with family again, waiting for a new job, waiting for a house, waiting for a paycheck,
waiting for a pandemic to be over.
We could go on and on. In this life, we are so accustomed to having to wait. And these are all important things that we are waiting on, and they can't be discounted. But we can't forget that in the midst of these waitings and these longings, that we, the church, are all collectively waiting for the return of Christ. Just as the people of God were waiting 2,000 years ago for a coming King, we are now waiting for the return of our King. But what are we doing during this time of waiting? Because we've already established that we are doing something. And how we wait and what we do to prepare matters. We often waste our potential in the present for a hope that we have in the future, when this is not what God has called us to do. We are called to build the kingdom while we are here on earth. And one of the best ways that we do that is through service. Oswald Chambers so beautifully yet so convictingly writes, "He works where he sends us to wait. Tarry until. Wait on the Lord and he will work. But don't wait sulking spiritually and feeling sorry for yourself just because you can't see one inch in front of you. Are we detached enough from our own spiritual fits of emotion to wait patiently for him? Waiting is not sitting with folded hands doing nothing, but it is learning to do what we are told." This morning, we will look further into what we are told to do during this time of waiting, because the Bible is very clear on how we are to prepare for Christ's return.
The Bible as a whole, as some of you or most of you probably know, is saturated with these times of waiting. We see Abraham and Sarah waiting on the promise, their promised child.
We see Joseph waiting in prison.
The Israelites waiting on their promised land.
David waiting to be king.
Jesus waiting to start his earthly ministry.
Paul and Silas waiting to be released from prison.
And John waiting to be executed. Each of these individuals continued to do what was right in front of them as they endured their wait. They did the next right thing. I mean, John was writing, you know, Revelation. Paul, you know, was being a missionary to the known world at the time. But part of this is because they prepared well as they waited. While we would love to dig into each one of these stories, I don't think we want to be here until next Sunday. So
talk about waiting.
Yeah. So we'll choose one of these that sort of parallels our own story of Jacob and Rachel. So just a quick overview first on Jacob. Jacob is the son of Isaac and Rebekah, Esau's twin, the younger twin to be exact. Jacob stole Esau's birthright, his inheritance. Turns out Esau, the older brother, wasn't too happy about this and threatened to kill his brother. Turns out he ran. Makes sense. I would do it too. Esau was described as a big hairy man who hunted and, you know, killed things in the woods for a living. And Esau was described as the guy who cooked stew. So probably going to run away from that. And he ended up at his uncle Laban's in a place called Padam Aram, which is where we pick up in today's story in Genesis 29, verse 16 through 20. Now Laban had two daughters. The older daughter, his name was named Leah, and the younger one was Rachel. There was no sparkle in Leah's eyes, but Rachel had a beautiful figure and a lovely face. Since Jacob was in love with Rachel, he told her father, "I will work for you for 7 years if you'll give me Rachel, your younger daughter, as my wife." "Agreed," Laban replied. "I'd rather give her to you than to anyone else. Stay and work with me." So Jacob worked 7 years to pay for Rachel, but his love for her was so strong that it seemed to him but a few days. Now we waited 2.5 years, but 7 years would be a really long time. I don't think we could have made it through it. But he willingly chose, he suggested 7 years. And Laban obviously eagerly agreed to this for multiple reasons. Jacob was so in love with Rachel that he was willing to pay any price. And having fled to his uncle Laban's, Jacob was penniless and couldn't afford what we would normally consider to be a bride's price. And this is not how he wasn't paying for, like you would pay for, you know, a loaf of bread. This was compensating for a family for the loss of a family member and also sort of paying for the room and board that she had accrued while she lived with her family beforehand. So the only way he could pay for this was through 7 years of service. And Jacob would work as a shepherd tending Laban's flock. Now, we have some understanding of the bride price. And 7 years of service, even for what we understand a bride price to be, was pretty hefty of a cost. But there are a few things that need to be made clear. Jacob serving Laban had consequences beyond just Rachel's bride price. That's why Laban was so excited to say, "Yes, this would be awesome." Laban would have seen the transaction as more of an adoption of Jacob into the family and all of his inheritance into Laban's. So that inheritance that he stole from Esau, Laban was like, "Hey, I see this coming with it too. This is a really good deal on my end." Unfortunately for Laban, Jacob didn't see it that way. You know, on top of getting a diligent worker, Laban saw this family member and wanted to enrich himself. But Jacob saw those 7 years of service as gaining a wife, a partner, someone that he loved. And his payment would be forthcoming after the 7 years. If that service wasn't up to par with the contract, Laban could have called it off. And so Jacob had to work diligently. Because of this, Jacob not only had to serve Laban for those 7 years, but he had to do everything he had in him, or else he wouldn't have been the proper payment for his bride. Now, obviously, Jacob wasn't idle for those 7 years. He worked for Laban during the times of waiting. It's easy to become inactive. We would rather sit back and wait for the fulfillment of what we are waiting for instead of doing something. But waiting is never passive. It's an important note that Jacob saw this time to be no burden at all. Like it says in verse 20, but his love for her was so strong that it seemed to him but a few days. Why was he willing to wait and endure these 7 years? Because his love for Rachel, the length of time reveals the depth of Jacob's love for her. His motivation was love. Our willingness to wait is a reflection of how we perceive what we are waiting for. How important is that thing that you're waiting for? What are you doing to prepare for it? When our time of waiting is used to prepare, then we work in our waiting, the wait becomes less of a burden.
So when looking at the waiting and preparation that comes with Advent, we would be remiss to not stop and look back at how the people of God waited for the coming Messiah. While our accounts are limited, we do have scriptural accounts of a few individuals who waited well, like Zechariah and Elizabeth, who we studied last week. Zechariah was found serving in the temple, Luke 1:9, when the angel appeared to promise the birth of John to both him and Elizabeth. Simeon and Anna were also part of the faithful Jewish remnant that eagerly looked for the coming Messiah. Luke makes a point to show Anna's faithfulness to the Lord in Luke chapter 2, verses 36 through 38. Now, Anna, a prophet, was also there in the temple. She was the daughter of Phanuel from the tribe of Asher, and she was very old. Her husband died when they had been married only 7 years. Then she lived as a widow to the age of 84. She never left the temple, but she stayed there day and night, worshiping God with fasting and prayer. She came along just as Simeon was talking with Mary and Joseph, and she began praising God. She talked about the child to everyone who had been waiting expectantly for God to rescue Jerusalem. While Anna waited for the coming Messiah, she worshiped God with fasting and prayer. She faithfully served God in the temple, even in her old age. If Anna had been married for 7 years and she was a widow for 84 years, she would have been well over 100 years old. Her faithfulness to serve in this time of waiting allowed her to see the Messiah with her own eyes. She did not give up in her waiting. She continued doing the thing that was right in front of her, serving while she waited. She devoted herself to serving God by worship through fasting and prayer. She remained in the temple waiting for the appearing of God's promised Messiah. Anna prepared well during her time of waiting as she remained faithful to God, serving him in the temple. She was faithful in the not yet.
Much like Anna waited for the coming Messiah and Jacob waited for his bride, Rachel, we, the church, are the bride of Christ, waiting for the wedding feast of the Lamb, the consummation that we talked about before. We read this in Revelation chapter 19, verses 6 through 8. Then I heard again what sounded like the shout of a vast crowd, or the roar of a mighty ocean waves, or the crash of loud thunder. Praise the Lord, for the Lord our God, the Almighty, reigns. Let us be glad and rejoice, and let us give honor to him, for the time has come for the wedding feast of the Lamb. And the bride has prepared herself. She has been given the finest of pure white linen to wear, for the fine linen represents the good deeds of God's holy people. As Christians, if you spend any time in the church, we talk about this idea, the bride of Christ. But what is the bride of Christ? We are the bride of Christ, the church universal, everyone who rightfully calls themselves a Christian. While this is meant to be a statement and action for the entire church, a direction for all churches to go, we as individuals within the church are called to the same work of preparation for the wedding feast of the Lamb. This idea comes from the Jewish betrothal and wedding period, which usually took about a year. Once you were betrothed, you were basically as good as married. It even took a divorce for you to separate. There was traditionally an entire year, and during this time, the groom would prepare a place attached to his father's home for the bride to go. He would build his own home attached to his father's complex, sort of. And this was so important, in fact, that the rabbi or the religious leader of the time would come in and inspect the new home to make sure that it was a better place than where she was coming from. Now, the bride was no slouch either in what she was doing. She was preparing herself. And meanwhile, she was tasked with creating and preparing her wedding garments. Now, those wedding garments in this analogy that John is bringing in Revelation are our good deeds as Christians. In the church's case, they're created from the good deeds of God's holy people. As it says in verse 8, the bride, the church, had made herself ready with fine linen given to her. This interconnection displays the active part in which we participate in that wedding and betrothal period. These good deeds are the outworking of our faith. These good deeds are not done just through our own sheer will, but through our faith in Christ. Our actions are outpourings of what God has already done for us. Paul shows us what this looks like in Philippians 2, or chapter 2, verses 12 through 13.
Therefore, my dear friends, just as you have always obeyed, so now, not only in my presence, but even more in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling.
Now, it's important to recognize that God does not call us to work for our salvation, because we have been saved by grace through faith. Our good works do not save us. Salvation is not earned through good deeds. Rather, good deeds follow a saving faith. Salvation is not gained through works, but instead good works are the fruit of salvation. When Paul says to work out our salvation, it means to apply salvation, not earn it. Paul was encouraging the believers of Philippi to work out. And this is not like I pick things up and I put them down sort of work out. Although, some Bibles are probably big enough that would work. No, this was more like sorting out or putting into practice in their daily living what they were called to do, what God had worked in them by his Holy Spirit. We work out our salvation by loving God and loving others. Paul's point is that salvation, once received, must be put into practice through obedience. Obedience is evidence of faith in God, and Paul is encouraging the people of Philippi to continue to obey, to adopt the attitude of Christ in their relationship with one another. And what is this attitude? If we look back just a few verses at Philippians 2, 5 through 7a, we discover what his attitude is to be, what this attitude is supposed to be.
Adopt the same attitude as that of Christ Jesus, who existing in the form of God, did not consider equality with God something to be exploited. Instead, he emptied himself by assuming the form of a servant, taking on the likeness of humanity.
So we see this incarnation. We see the likeness of Jesus, God becoming man, assuming the form of a servant, indicates that God the Son came to demonstrate true servanthood. Christ humbles himself to serve, and as Christ followers, we are called to do the exact same thing. We are to have the attitude of a servant, to lay aside our rights and serve. As Jesus said, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others, in Mark 10:45. So we serve and obey out of our love for God and what he's done for us. Our good works, our servanthood, reflect the love of God. Just as Jacob's willingness to serve Laban for 7 years reflected his love for Rachel, it enabled him to wait well. Therefore, our love for God should be reflected in how we wait. We must serve one another in love because of our love for God. Galatians 5:13 says, "For you have been called to live in freedom, my brothers and sisters, but don't use your freedom to satisfy your sinful nature. Instead, use your freedom to serve one another in love. For the whole law can be summed up in this one command: love your neighbor as yourself." So what does preparing in this time look like? What does it look like for us to prepare? We talked about Rachel and Jacob and Rachel. We've talked about Anna and Simeon. But what does it look like for us when we put on our wedding garments? It looks like living and working out our salvation and serving in love. In his commentary, one of my professors, Dr. Richard Eckley, writes this: "Our efforts to serve others are an evidence of our faith and help us weave fine linen for the wedding supper. While it's not our good works that get us into heaven, our righteousness, good actions do dress us. We need to be looking for opportunities to serve those in need. Who can you help? How will you help them? How will you do it? When will you do it? As we wait on God, he will reveal to us the people we can reach with his love. The opportunities are endless. Buy lunch for someone. Shovel someone's driveway. Volunteer in the community. Take an Angel Tree person for the Salvation Army. Donate items to Meadowbrook. Be a mentor to someone. Pay for the stranger's coffee behind you. Keep your eyes open and ask God for opportunities to serve those around you. Our good deeds are the outworking of our faith and will be what clothe us at the wedding feast of the Lamb.
So from these scriptures, we gain an understanding of what we are supposed to do in the waiting, especially as we await the coming of Christ. However, this waiting, this in-between, living in the already but not yet, is not easy. And even though we know what we are supposed to do, it's easy to grow tired and weary. Serving others can be fatiguing, both physically and spiritually. We also have eternity set in our hearts, so we have this longing to be at the not yet. But we aren't there. So what are we supposed to do in the meantime? Paul gives us some practical biblical encouragement in Galatians 6:9-10 as to what we are to do while we wait. "Let us not grow tired in doing good, for we will reap at the proper time if we don't give up. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us work for the good of all, especially for those who belong to the household of faith." In Galatians, Paul is writing to a church faced by legalism and libertinism. Now, libertinism is a lifestyle or pattern of behavior characterized by self-indulgence and a lack of restraint and rejection of religious or other moral authority. The Galatians were in danger of turning from God and a life of service towards petty bickering and self-concern. Therefore, Paul felt the need to encourage the believers in Galatia not to give up, to not become weary in what they were doing and the message of Christ that they were proclaiming. And I think we all need that same encouragement today. don't give up. Keep on serving in your waiting. We might not see the reward just yet, but the not yet is coming. So back to our story at the beginning, specifically that 2.5 year engagement period. It might have sounded like the preparation time was easy. We kind of listed off some of those things that we did during that time. You know, we planned and we prepared for our wedding and the time flew right by. 2 years felt like a few days, as Jacob would say.
It didn't.
That was not true. The waiting to be married, the preparation, the long engagement was not easy. There were actually moments that we thought it might be easier just to give up and elope. We vividly remember one instance where we were seriously considering eloping. We devised a whole plan in our minds of how it would work. And goodness, even Jordan was in town so he could still marry us. But had we given in at that moment, had we decided to elope, we would have missed the beauty of the ending we had, a wedding surrounded by our family and friends. And we also would have missed out on that vital time of preparation. We don't want to miss out on all that God has for us because we are unwilling to wait well. So we needed to, just as the church needs to, take to heart Paul's encouragement at the end of Galatians. We need to persevere, to wait patiently. Perseverance is critical to us as believers. The Message version puts it as this: we will harvest a good crop if we don't give up. Now, I grew up in town. My grandparents lived in the country, but I haven't even had a garden of my own, so I don't know much about harvesting. But what I do know is that you cannot expect to harvest as soon as you plant. It takes time. And if we become weary during this time between the harvest and the reaping, you will miss out on experiencing the crop. So Paul reminds us that we will reap a harvest at the proper time if we don't give up. So Paul ends with this word, proper time, which is kairos in Greek. And this is the same word that Paul uses in Galatians 4:4 to describe the opportune moment, the fullness of time in which God sent his son into the world. But when the right time came, the kairos time, God sent his son, born of a woman subject to the law. And this is also the same expression used in 1 Timothy 6:15 to describe the second advent of Christ. For at just the right time, the kairos, Christ will be revealed from heaven by the blessed and only Almighty God, the King of kings and Lord of lords. Christ's promised return, the consummation, the wedding feast is coming, but we are living in the waiting. And we will see an eternal blessing if we don't give up in the already but not yet. I love how practical Ann Voskamp puts it. If you are waiting on God, do what waiters do. Serve. We are to serve in the waiting. So we'd like to invite the worship team back up as we get ready to close the service today. We're going to be ending our service today with the song, Build My Life. The chorus ends with, lead me in your love to those around me. This Advent season, in the already, but not yet, may our prayer be that God will lead us in his love to his service. May we serve like Jacob did as he waited for Rachel. And may we faithfully serve God like Anna. And may we, the bride of Christ, prepare ourselves through a life of service as we await the second advent and anticipate Christ's promised return.